It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how a Wisconsin lawmaker tried to help resolve a conflict between Eau Claire County and its Amish population.
First, we've heard a lot this year about gun violence in Milwaukee, but the state's biggest city isn't alone in dealing with that issue.
Last month, La Crosse was shaken by a string of shooting incidents, including the fatal shooting of a 17-year-old high school student by an 18-year-old.
Yesterday, residents gathered for a vigil and a community building event. In a press release, organizers say they want to, quote, replace the old story of isolation and fear with a new story of coming together and compassion.
Thomas Harris is one of the organizers of the event. He's a senior student service coordinator for multicultural student services at UW La Crosse. He joins us now from our studio in La Crosse. Thomas, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Ron.
Well, can you tell us more about that idea of replacing isolation and fear with a new story of compassion and coming together in response to a shooting like this?
Well, it was really the Martin Luther King Planning Committee. We have an annual event every year, and we were just wondering, what could we do? And we met before our regular planning meeting, and we kind of came up with this. We really didn't know what the result was going to be, but we definitely knew that we wanted to bring people together to give them the option to express themselves, their feelings, what might be able to be done for the future, and maybe the outcomes that we might be looking for.
So who did end up speaking at the event yesterday, and what kind of things were they saying?
Wow. I don't remember how many spoke. We started with a list of about 7 or 8 people who were contacted, or they contacted our committee in order to at least know that they were going to be the featured speakers or start off the program. And then it was pretty much open mic where people came up, provided their name in writing, and then they just lined up and they spoke in sequence. There's probably about 20, 25 people, I'm guessing. We kicked off with Mario Street and his group from Impact Records starting off to kind of set the mood. It was moderated or facilitated by two community leaders, Curtis Miller, who really is the chair of the Martin Luther King Planning Committee, and he has been for a number of years, and Shondell Spivey, who's an employee at UW La Crosse also, who just finished his master's degree, but he's one of the gentlemen, African-American males, that was also living on the South Side when everything kind of transpired.
And I understand the father of the suspect in that shooting we mentioned spoke, and it sounded like he had some powerful messages for the people there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was towards the end. I think he was like maybe 3 individuals before, maybe 2 other individuals spoke right after him, including me. And his name is Fletcher Miller, and he said he kind of gave a brief history because you only had a short time period to speak, but he shared that he had a short history of being incarcerated and now to see his son being in a situation where he's in court for the accused, the accused person who actually did the shooting, to be in the courtroom with the possibility of a long time being in jail was just, I mean, just a tearful thing. And I can't speak for Fletcher, but I would imagine that he's been going through, I would say, a million emotions.
Talking to Thomas Harris from UW La Crosse, talking about an event yesterday in La Crosse, a vigil, a community gathering in response to some recent shootings there last month. So there were messages, it sounds like, directed to youth and to adults in La Crosse. What were people trying to tell the youth at this event yesterday?
I think the main thing, or some of the main things, definitely me being an educator, and I'm an assistant director of the Office of Multicultural Student Services at UWL. Even my our director of the office was there, Antoina Williams, which really emphasized education. For the young folks to get it, for the young folks to get opportunities in school and out of school to be successful individuals in their growth and development throughout their lives. But in order for that to happen, they have to have the support of parents, if they have parents, and community members, or people who are responsible in the area where they live, and so on. So that was definitely number one as far as directed towards youth. And youth really, really, even if they're not happy or the happiest on the education that they're getting, I remember Antoina saying specifically that you need to push on so maybe you can end up being the teacher or end up being the principal, and then at that point you can make change happen. You know, so the whole idea is to get yourself in the best position to do that. I also think that there was information about that went out towards the adults who are really, we have to take a greater responsibility to help the communities so things like this don't happen. I think in some ways we can almost say like we fail some of our young people to get into positions like this. Some of the other things had to do with cell phones and the overusage of them and not doing face-to-face communication, and that might lead to less of a chance of caring for one another because you don't have those interpersonal conversations and so on. And just the fact of trying to get rid of guns and not to have the guns to be so accessible so anybody can just get them, because a youth shouldn't have a gun, and probably many people shouldn't have guns. But that definitely would be a help. Those are some things that were said. There were people who spoke who had relatives and community members and other community members who had been shot too. So there was a lot shared from a lot of different angles.
And Thomas, can you describe just the range of emotions that people were expressing at this event yesterday?
I wouldn't say it was it was a wide range. There was African American folks speaking of all ages, not as many youth as that we wished. There was the girlfriend of George Miller, who was the gentleman that we're talking about from Central High School here in La Crosse. There was an administrator from Central High School who had a chance to speak. The mayor spoke and encouraged our community to continue to have conversations like this, but conversations that are also going to lead to change, where we can use the ideas and actually put them on the table for implementation. Ideas of maybe having college students join some of the community organizations that might be working on efforts like this, like the Human Rights Commission through the city of La Crosse, or joining the Martin Luther King Planning Committee. You know, college students from Viterbo, Western Technical College, and UW La Crosse, you know, sometimes just stay on campus, but sometimes they don't really realize that the campuses are within a community and they can be a part of the change. So once they leave and go someplace else, they still can do the same thing. But at the same time, it would be great if they could stay here and keep the wheels a-turning. It was just a wide, wide range of people speaking.
And La Crosse isn't generally thought of, I think, from the outside as a place that's dangerous or violent. Do you think, from what you heard and what you've seen outside of that event, too, do you think it will stay that way, that maybe this can be just a bad month, but it's not a sign of things to come?
I hope so. There was even talk, you know, and I'm originally from Milwaukee, but I've been gone for quite a long time living in La Crosse. I think when you see things going on like this, or hear things, or you're in a community like this and something like this happens, you And one of the gentlemen, I think it was Sheldon Williams, who said this, and he's 37-year-old African-American male who's really connected with the youth and people in the, up to the age that he is, 37. And he said, this isn't over. There are some things that are still lingering, particularly in the African-American community, and with the community of La Crosse being a predominantly white community population, there's some apprehension that some of this is going to continue. But that doesn't mean that we don't stop trying to stop and to slow down things and to be working on this. And I think that's just where our community is.
And with that in mind, that you're looking at this as something to still be working on, after yesterday's gathering, what's next? What kind of things are people talking about doing in the coming weeks and months?
We haven't really had that conversation, but our committee, we did take notes. We had a couple of note takers in the audience from our committee. I'm sure we're going to be looking at that. I know that next Wednesday, which will be the 16th of September, at the Black River Beach Neighborhood Center, they call it here in La Crosse, by the Perkins on the north side at 6 o'clock, there's going to be a listening session where the community is invited, but the focus is really going to be on the African-American community, and we want individuals to come and share their experiences in the La Crosse community and neighboring areas about their situations of discrimination, racism, and just oppression, so we can really have a better idea of what we're dealing with just based on that community. And there will be some future sessions that will take place that will have different population focuses. So that's one thing. I think there's definitely some things going on in the schools with the La Crosse School District, Onalaska School District, Holman, and surrounding areas. It's definitely always programming and acts of change that are happening on our college campuses, particularly UWL, because I work there and I'm very aware of that. We're one of the things that we're hoping to do, and I think we're close to finalizing the negotiations on October 29th, which is a Thursday. We're hoping that we can finalize the deal where we can have some of the frontline individuals who were involved in Ferguson to be on our campus at 7 o'clock that night to speak about what those experiences were like, also to share what can we do in our community to make sure that we don't get to a place like that.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Rob.
That was Thomas Harris, Senior Student Service Coordinator and Assistant Director for Multicultural Student Services at UW La Crosse, talking about yesterday's community building event in response to recent shooting incidents. Wisconsin is not an early primary state, which means we don't always get a lot of love and attention from the candidates or the national media. This year has been a little different, with a candidate from Wisconsin, of course, Governor Scott Walker, on the Republican side. The state is also getting attention from Democratic candidates as well. Bernie Sanders has made a visit, and now tonight, for the first time in her campaign, Hillary Clinton is coming to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee, to be precise.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's here to talk about that visit this evening. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Well, tell us a little bit, if you would, about why Hillary Clinton is in Milwaukee this evening.
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's her closest competition right now for the Democratic nomination, has already been to Wisconsin. He drew a big crowd in Madison in early July. So I think it's natural for Hillary Clinton to come here at this stage of the race. It is a important, obviously, general election state, even though we don't have an early primary. We do have a primary that could matter in a long race, and we also have a debate. We're one of six states that has a Democratic debate. We're one of nine states that has a Republican debate. So there's a lot going on in Wisconsin. What's interesting is that Bernie Sanders made his trip to Madison, and Hillary Clinton is making hers to Milwaukee. And it's kind of emblematic of the two kind of sides of the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders seem to be drawing their support from right now.
And Hillary Clinton's popularity is down a bit in Wisconsin right now. Some polling shows that she would still fare the best in a matchup between challengers like Donald Trump and Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. But in general, what do you make of her numbers here in Wisconsin as she comes into this visit?
Well, they definitely reflect, you know, her national trend, which is a loss of support as this email controversy drags on and takes its toll. On the other hand, she is more than competitive in general election matchups in Wisconsin against major Republican figures, and she's certainly, you know, competitive for the Democratic nomination. She leads Bernie Sanders by low double digits in the last poll that the Marquette Law School did recently. The two are as I said earlier, are kind of appealing to different kinds of Democrats, and it gives them each sort of a base in a state like Wisconsin. Bernie Sanders is doing better with men. He's doing better with more independent-minded Democrats. He's doing better with liberal Democrats. He's doing better with college-educated Democrats. Those are all things you can imagine would make him popular in the Madison area. And Hillary Clinton is doing better with women. She's doing better with blue-collar white Democrats, she's doing better with more moderate Democrats, and those are all reasons why you can imagine her doing better. And she's also doing better with African-Americans, why you can imagine her doing better in a place like Milwaukee. I think Bernie Sanders could certainly give her a run for her money in a state like Wisconsin, where, incidentally, Hillary Clinton didn't have a very good primary in 2008 against Barack Obama.
Is Milwaukee a common stop for fundraising for national candidates like this?
Absolutely. I mean, it is the, you know, kind of financial center of Wisconsin. And as you go around from state to state, it's kind of a natural place for her. She is holding a fundraiser as well as having a public event in Milwaukee today.
Now, it's just a couple of days ago that she apologized for her actions involving a private email server. That was a story that's been a long time evolving over the summer months. Do you expect her to make any reference to that tonight? And do you expect people to ask her about it?
You know, I don't know how much opportunity people are going to have to ask her questions. I would not necessarily expect her to bring it up, but it kind of depends on, you know, what they've decided is the most effective way for her to address this, to put it to rest. She's, as you alluded to in interviews, she's gone, you know, a little bit further in terms of being contrite about it and ceding a little more ground on it. But I'm sure they're anxious, you know, to kind of move on if they feel like they can and talk about other things.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about Hillary Clinton's visit to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee, in fact, this evening. And Craig, when Bernie Sanders was in Madison earlier this year, he drew record-sized crowds, and there were lots of pictures in the media about the masses of people there to see Bernie Sanders. Does Hillary Clinton at this point have that same kind of draw for the event tonight, for example?
You know, probably not. I mean, I'm sure she can build a crowd. I mean, I'm not sure she can build kind of a Bernie Sanders-style crowd because of what Bernie Sanders is tapping into, and particularly in a place like Madison, where Madison has a long history of just turning out like crazy at Democratic events. I mean, mass crowd events in the past, tens of thousands of people, and which doesn't diminish what Bernie Sanders was able to do, but that was a perfect venue for him to get that kind of a turnout. And it's still early in the process. And I think, you know, part of what Hillary Clinton is struggling with is that she's not kind of lighting a fire under Democratic voters. And it may turn out that she doesn't have to, but she does, you know, that's what she's competing with in terms of Bernie Sanders, kind of the passion of the Bernie Sanders vote. I think that Bernie Sanders, you know, may have a ceiling, and he certainly needs to broaden his own coalition in order to seriously challenge Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. But what he's got going for him right now is that kind of grassroots passion. But that isn't always a formula for victory in either party.
Now, of course, still early in the season here, but how important do you expect Wisconsin as a whole to be in the upcoming presidential race?
Well, if we're talking about the nominating contest, it does, as you noted, does come late in the process. So it all depends on how protracted these races are. So, you know, the later states, chances are the later states won't matter. But if the race drags on, then they become really important. and they could really, you know, really matter a lot. Our primaries aren't until April. Wisconsin is a state that really turns out like crazy compared to other states in these primaries. And so I think that carries some weight in terms of people, how people perceive the results. It's not a state whose primary is just decided by a handful of kind of ideological voters. It's an open primary. It's a big electorate. So there's a scenario where it matters on both sides if the races last long enough, then that certainly seems like it's at least plausible on the Republican side because of the size of the field and how fractured it is. And if you think that Donald Trump doesn't have staying power, then you're looking at a recipe for a long race. And then, obviously, in the general election, Wisconsin is a state that's at times has been right on the 50-yard line of American politics. And when Republicans really target the state and really maximize their effort here, they've proven that they can make the state very competitive. They just haven't, you know, ultimately had success in some time in winning the state.
Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
That is Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us to talk about Hillary Clinton's visit to Milwaukee this evening.
The civil war in Syria has displaced huge numbers of people, with millions fleeing to neighboring countries, tens of thousands seeking the dangerous, sometimes deadly passage to Europe, along with refugees from other war-torn countries. The world's humanitarian resources are struggling to keep up, and the nations of the European Union are debating how many refugees each of them should take in.
The crisis is reaching into American politics. The U.S. has taken in about 1,500 Syrian refugees since the conflict started. Secretary of State John Kerry said yesterday the country can take in more.
We are committed to increasing the number of refugees that we take, and we are looking hard at the number that we can specifically manage.
The White House put a number on that effort today, aiming to take in 10,000 refugees next year. Wisconsin Governor and presidential candidate Scott Walker disagreed this week, saying the United States has invested enough.
No, we shouldn't be taking on any more Syrian refugees right now.
Two Wisconsin guests join us now for a look at the scope of the crisis and the humanitarian challenges it poses to the world. Karen Solheim is clinical professor of nursing at UW-Madison. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Elise Cohen is assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Elise, in speaking and writing about this issue, you say the Syrian refugee crisis is the biggest since World War II. What is the scope of this problem?
Yes, well, a lot of people are saying that right now this is actually one of the defining humanitarian challenges of our times. To sort of give you a sense of that, just looking at the Syrian refugee crisis, which is one that I've really focused on in my research, we're talking about over 4 million Syrians that are registered with the United Nations, and that's just referring to registered refugees. So those are just the ones that have been able to get out of the Syrian conflict and civil war, which is also now a proxy war. Inside of Syria, of course, we're looking at over 7 million that are internally displaced with another level of humanitarian crisis, but lacking the international protection that's supposed to come with being a refugee. So to give you a sense of those numbers, I mean, right now, in terms of a global perspective, we have over 59 million that are displaced and about 20 million that are refugees. But right now, Syrians are really leading in terms of the numbers, and it's estimated that one in every four refugees worldwide right now is from Syria.
And Karen, with numbers like that, millions taking refuge in neighboring countries, huge numbers going even further away, what are the biggest priorities from a humanitarian perspective?
Well, really, people have to start with the basics. So food, shelter, water, soap, clothing, and then move on really to health care. And people could be, how people fare when they've left their homes depends upon their health condition before they left. So if they have chronic illnesses and can't get medicines, that's going to put them at risk. Likely they've suffered trauma in their flight of some kind, and so may have mental health issues. They're grieving from loss of their homes. People may have mental health issues from the trauma. And then, of course, in such conditions, people may be more exposed to communicable diseases, so that's another issue.
And does the world have the capacity to provide that huge list of things you just mentioned, the basics, the healthcare infrastructure, quickly enough to make a difference?
You know, I'm an optimist. I think we do. It's very difficult to organize and manage the logistics. But when it comes down to it, I think it's a matter of political will.
And Elise, let's follow up on the political will there, especially in the developed nations, Europe, the United States. Are those countries meeting their responsibility to help deal with humanitarian crises like this?
That's a great question, because as my fellow professor here said, it really is a problem of political will. It's not about capacity. So if you look at Europe, for example, we see that it's really a small number compared to the European Union with all 28 member states. You know, it's roughly 500 million people. Right now, those coming in, most of which are refugees, fleeing these mass atrocity situations in the Middle East and Africa, it's about 340,000 that are coming in. That's only 0.068, actually, percentage-wise of the population. So, I mean, the capacity is there, and certainly when you take into account the level of wealth in these developed countries, it really is a political will issue. Same thing for the U.S. I mean, we have this availability where we could follow up on the international legal expectations for this concept called responsibility to protect. A lot of world leaders actually say that we do agree that all human life deserves to be protected under international law. But then when it comes down to it goes back to the political problem and those that are actually the voters in these countries, many of which are, of course, strong democracies, the pressures from those voters not wanting to take in these people and their perceptions of who these people are, that really right now, in my view, is one of the chief obstacles to meeting our humanitarian responsibilities.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, and Karen Solheim, clinical professor of nursing at UW-Madison, looking at the Syrian refugee crisis. Let's follow up on that point, Elise. You've written actually about this, a bias against people, migrants, refugees, whatever they're called in the local country. You see personal and political bias affecting rescue efforts, humanitarian efforts.
Absolutely. So in one of the projects, I was looking at the public opinion data, and we can see these trends have been in the European countries really in the last 5 to 10 years. They've been growing sort of an anti-migrant sentiment. Of course, we're familiar with similar sentiments even in our own democracy. But the view that these people coming in are just part of a larger migrant population that perhaps is going to be a burden on the economy or take, you know, valuable social services from the citizens in those places. And these anti-migrant views, you know, viewing the refugees really just lumping them in with migrants rather than seeing the exact circumstances, which are truly emergency humanitarian catastrophic circumstances that they're fleeing, has resulted in anti-migrant violence. So, I mean, Germany is one of those cases where, even though they have done an amazing job in leading among the European countries to take in refugees and grant asylum, you know, we've seen over 200 arson attacks on asylum seeker shelters. We've seen physical assaults on people that are either, you know, refugees or are even just perceived to be migrants or refugees or somehow, you know, non-Europeans. So this is really having a problem, and it's especially for those that have survived, if they have made the dangerous journey from the Middle East and North Africa across the Mediterranean, if they have made that dangerous journey, which many have perished, over 2,000, according to the International Organization of Migration, have already died trying to make that journey, sea crossing journey this year. But once they make it, then if they are faced with these anti-migrant sentiments and actual physical attacks or arson attacks on the shelters, they are still not safe.
And Karen, we've been focusing so far on the role of governments in the West. You've worked on the role of non-governmental organizations in providing relief in refugee situations. Where do they fit into the picture?
Well, they're huge. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees partners with over 600 NGOs to deliver their deliver health care and basic services to refugees and internally displaced people around the world. They do all sorts of things, from provide education to emergency health care to ongoing health care, community health education, all sorts of things. Just about every service inside a camp and often to displaced people is delivered by international NGOs. May I add something
yes.
about the movement of people across the world?
Yes, please.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has three durable solutions for refugees. One is repatriation, going back voluntarily to their home country when things are peaceful. The second is integration into the local community. And the third option is resettlement to a country like the U.S., Australia, and so forth. And just under 1% of refugees are resettled in countries outside where they live in asylum. So it's really a very small percentage of refugees that are actually resettled around the world. I think there's room for taking more.
We're talking about the Syrian refugee crisis with UW-Madison clinical nursing professor Karen Solheim and political scientist Elise Cohen of UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think the United States should do in response to the refugee crisis? Should we join European countries in taking in tens of thousands of refugees? Is this a story that's personally affected you in some way? And if you're from Syria, please share your thoughts. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about the Syrian refugee crisis. Karen Solheim is with us. She's the director of the Global Health Initiative at UW-Madison. Also with us is Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, should the U.S. be doing in response to the growing refugee crisis? If you're from the region, do you have family members affected by this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I will go to a caller now. We have Stephen on the line in Milwaukee. Stephen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in. I'm extremely liberal. I'm a school teacher. I'm a socialist. And I'm very much a humanitarian, I feel. In this particular instance, though, I think that it's slightly different. I think that right now the economy is horrible. The unemployment numbers are misreported. There are a tremendous amount of people, and I work in the inner city. There's a tremendous amount of children who are starving right now. They're malnourished. Their parents don't, some of them don't have jobs, incomes of nothing other than the assistance they're getting from the government, which has been reduced. I think that we have a moral obligation to the impoverished in this country and the shrinking middle class.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring our guests in on this. Elise Cohen, you've written about the concept of responsibility to protect. Can you make the case that with problems here at home, we have a responsibility to protect people in the situation in a situation like Syria?
Yeah, it's a really great point. So I thank the caller for bringing this up. This is actually one of the key issues that we see, not just in our democracy, but in others as well, when the question of taking in refugees that are fleeing these mass atrocity situations comes, you know, well, how does this compare to the problems that we have in our own economy and with our own people, and certainly perhaps our own levels of oppression or human rights violations that we're still solving? And, you know, my response would be that one does not prohibit the other. So the fact that there is a greater need to address the poverty and problems regarding the economy in this country does not mean that we cannot also fulfill our responsibility to protect. Let me give a little bit of context for this caller's question. Already, you know, the U.S. takes in about 70,000 refugees a year. The Congress each year sort of sets a cap or a ceiling on that number. The issue with that is that they also set regional caps so that, you know, only a certain amount can be from the Middle East and North Africa. No places as of now have been specifically set aside for only Syrians. And when they start talking about, well, maybe 5 or 10,000, this is not clear how it would relate to the broader global cap on the number of refugees that can come in. So we're already doing a lot. We're already giving billions in humanitarian aid. So I don't think it's a question of we can't do anything to help a humanitarian crisis. It really is part of our history and how we define ourselves that we are contributing international aid and helping with these sorts of situations. The question is really just a restructuring and looking at the system we have, which right now takes about 1 to 2 years for all of the screenings that are done in order to give asylum. So it's really something that's more procedural that we could address, and it doesn't mean that at the same time our elected officials can't also work on fixing our domestic problems.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Karen, can you lay out some, maybe the urgency of the lives faced by people maybe in a camp in Turkey or Lebanon right now?
What might their lives be like, or what's the urgency for
exactly.
them to have help? Certainly, yeah. Really, the population in Syria right now, over half are living below, or 86% are below the poverty line, living in extreme poverty. So it is, I think, very crucial. And camps, the condition in camps varies. In some camps in Turkey are very well set up, providing education, good health care, markets, people grow gardens, and people from those types of camps haven't fled. Other camps aren't quite so fortunate. Some of the world food budget is being cut, and people are being separated from their food given by the UN. So I think there is a very crucial need. And I like to think of the U.S. as really an important global player and citizen. And without demeaning our own issues at home, which are extremely important, but I'd rather see it as a both-and issue. And we're clearly involved in the politics of Syria and looking at our policy there and solutions. So I think we have to work at the issue from both ends.
Talking to Karen Solheim and Elise Cohen about the ongoing Syria refugee crisis. Art joins us next in Green Bay. Art, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I've heard so many people that probably come from the same perspective as your guests complain for many years that the U.S. can't be the policeman of the world. But now you see what happens when the policeman of the world pulls out of areas that need policing. This is a completely created crisis created by the foreign policies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and carried on by John Kerry. And now what you're seeing is not necessarily a refugee issue, but a mass migration issue. And if you read some of the information that's provided by the Islamic groups, you'll find that what they're looking at doing is establishing a caliphate worldwide by doing exactly what this is going on, what's going on now.
Art, I want to give a guest a chance to chime in on that. Elise, a quick response to what Art brought up there.
Yes, this is another common response, and there are two points I want to raise in the framing of the caller's question that I think are important. So he's bringing up on one hand the militant groups like ISIS. We also have Jabhat al-Nusra and others that are involved in Syria. This is one of the reasons that the humanitarian emergency for the Syrian people is so dire, because not only is it from the government, the Assad regime, barrel bombing within Syria, but also these militant groups that are really wreaking havoc on ordinary people that are trying to flee. So this is an important thing to keep in mind when we think about the fact that many of these refugees are coming from a Muslim-majority country, which scares some Americans and just kind of lumping together all Muslims with the militant groups. But actually, they are the victims of the militant groups. They are the primary victims of ISIS in Syria, are the Syrian people that are fleeing. And the second point is that framing it as a migrant problem. So, you know, refugees have been defined in international law and the U.S. Refugee Act that follows it as somebody leaving or fleeing from a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race or nationality or political opinion, among other things. And we have enough evidence at this point that we can definitely say, and the United Nations has said, anybody that is fleeing the situation in Syria absolutely qualifies and meets these conditions as a refugee. And migrant is really just someone who chooses to leave because they have a choice and they may be looking for improving their economic situation. But the vast majority of these people are refugees, do meet that standard that has been set out by international law.
We'll leave it there for now. Elise, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Karen, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Karen Solheim, clinical professor of nursing and director of the Global Health Initiative at UW-Madison, and Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, talking about the refugee situation in Syria.